This is Judaism Unbound, episode 63, JewTube. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here today in the third episode of our exploration of the Omer. So to remind listeners what this is all about, we're exploring the Omer over these 7 weeks. The Omer is a 7-week period between the holidays of Passover and Shavuot, and we generally count each day, each week of the Omer, and we're trying to explore this as a time in Jewish life where we can kind of think of ourselves as having left Egypt behind, but not yet gotten to Mount Sinai, where whatever the new Judaism is there for us. And this is the time of wandering, the time of least knowing, the time of most exploration. And we specifically thought that it would be fun to explore Silicon Valley as a landscape of exploration, not knowing, experimentation that's particularly alive in our time today. And imagining that maybe by talking to people who are working in that kind of environment in Silicon Valley, we can glean ideas for what might actually help us in exploring Judaism. And we're really excited today to be talking with Una King from YouTube. I'll introduce her a little bit more later. But the idea, for me at least, of starting with YouTube comes from the advice that we talked about a couple weeks ago when we talked with our friends from the Ashman family, JCC in Palo Alto, who have helped us put together this series, Zach Bodner and Tova Birnbaum. And we explored some of the stories in the book of Exodus that are really about that beginning of the period of wandering. And this really important early story is when Moses' father-in-law Jethro comes and gives Moses this various forms of leadership advice, one of the most prominent being that he should essentially break the people up into groups of 10. And at least for me, thinking about YouTube, it's kind of like thinking about these technologies that we're starting to have with the internet that fundamentally allow every single person to be seen and heard and to participate not only as somebody who's being led, but as somebody who's intimately connected with the larger endeavor, in a similar way to what I think Jethro is getting out of that story, that in a time of transition, one of the things that you really can do is empower the people at the very close level to the ground. And I think that in our time, technologies like YouTube and other forms of social media are really giving us an example of how that might work.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I just wanted to mention as we embark on our journey into this episode that you'll notice I'm rather quiet. This is Lex speaking. And this episode and our next few weeks episodes actually don't feature me in the body of the episode. I know it's sad. Maybe it's not sad for some of you, but I'm not in the body of these episodes. I'll be here for the introduction and I'll wave goodbye at what we call the outro, the conclusion, but I won't be there in the body. And the reason for that is that Dan actually conducted this interview and a few of our next week's interviews in person. He made a trip out to Silicon Valley and he was able to break the Skype barrier, break the telephone barrier that we usually have involved for our interviews. And so these interviews actually take place in person. So I got to be just a listener for these episodes, which I enjoyed. I got to step into the shoes of all of you out there. So I hope you'll enjoy this one, and I think that you will. It was a great conversation.
So I want to introduce our guest today. Her name is Una King. She is the Director of Diverse Marketing at YouTube. She has a really interesting story beyond that. Una was a member of the British Parliament from 1997 to 2005, representing the Labour Party. And then in 2011, she was appointed to the House of Lords as the Baroness King of Bow. So she's actually our first Lord, or I suppose, what is a female Lord?
Well, the most famous lord in the world right now is a female, Lord the singer.
True.
You know, never be royal.
So Una is actually our first baroness and possibly our last baroness that will ever be a guest on Judaism Unbound. I never really thought that I would say a line like that in an introduction, but we're very excited to have her on the show, both in terms of her experience in politics and in leadership, which is very valuable for the lens that we're trying to bring to this question of leading through the wilderness, but also her role now as the Director of Diverse Marketing at YouTube, where she's currently on leave from the House of Lords. I did not know that you could do that, but she is on leave from the House of Lords to take this important position at YouTube, where she's working on making sure that the voices of people from vastly different and diverse backgrounds are all able to make their voices heard on YouTube. So with that, we're really excited to share with you my interview with Una King. Una, thank you so much for joining us on Judaism Unbound.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here, although a little bit scared having looked at all the incredibly erudite people that you've interviewed before. So hoping not to utterly disappoint.
I don't think you will.
We'll see.
But here's it's an interesting segue to my comment / question, which was when I told my daughter, who's 10, that I was going to be coming to YouTube headquarters to interview somebody who works at YouTube, she got really excited and she said, "Are you going to get to meet any famous YouTubers?" And, you know, I said to her, "Well, not really, because they don't work at YouTube headquarters like YouTubers. The whole point of YouTube is that YouTubers are everywhere." And what was extraordinary to me and just sort of that comment from her is deeply about the change that YouTube sort of stands for, among other things in this world of the digital age, is that it sort of turned regular people into the superstars. And in a way, what we're trying to do in terms of Judaism is to push that capacity to regular people Jewishly and to say, right, what would it look like if we could somehow make regular people, right, in an age when knowledge is widely available, where all sorts of creative tools are widely available, what would it look like to sort of push that responsibility and that capacity to create to regular people? And so that's my sort of interest here in YouTube. And thinking about that, I'm curious, you know, you're new here, what, you know, whether you came with some of those thoughts in mind.
What a huge question. Yeah, I should say by way of passing that my 11-year-old son regularly lobbies me every morning as I'm going out the door. When I was on my way to Downing Street to see the Prime Minister, he couldn't care less. Now that I'm on my way to YouTube, he won't let me leave. He's like, "Who are you going to meet? Can I meet them? Have you met so-and-so and so-and-so?" In fact, I'm ashamed to say that he made me sit down. My job, I should have done it anyway, but he made me sit down and watch PewDiePie's apology for putting up "Death to All Jews," you know, in a blog post. And it really, or as a vlog, it really did make me think, what an extraordinary impact this medium has, that an 11-year-old can be looking at this and has such an affinity to a YouTuber that he's never met, that when this YouTuber does something utterly outrageous, and, you know, my 11-year-old knows that his mum is Jewish. And yet he's like, "No, mum, he didn't mean it. No, he's not being represented properly. And mum, all the other YouTubers, they defend him as well. And they say he's right as well." And I'm like, "Darling, just because you've got YouTubers saying it's right doesn't make it right." But it does make you wonder for the future. And actually, frankly, that's why I'm here, because YouTube just has such an extraordinary reach, in some ways, unbelievably positive. I mean, if you'd seen the video that I saw of the 15-year-old girl from Afghanistan, Muslim girl, who was sold basically as a slave, and then a forced marriage, and then managed essentially to escape via YouTube because she became a rapper. And you honestly, you just can't compute the different variations that YouTube plus globalization plus millennials plus technology leads to. It's utterly extraordinary. And so although, you know, as I'm obviously indicating by mentioning PewDiePie in the first 10 seconds of the interview, there are huge issues. The reason I'm here is because I see the possibilities as well. And, you know, you want to have some impact on how the next generation is going to think, and also learn from them about how they think and why they think and what they think. So, yeah, in a nutshell, that is why I left the British Parliament to come to YouTube.
I should say you're the first member of the House of Lords on this show, so you may be intimidated by some of the other erudite people that we've had, but they should be intimidated by you.
Well, no, but, you know, the House of Lords, it was funny because I became a member of the House of Lords just at that point in life when you think you're getting old. You know, you turn 40, you're in your early 40s, you're grappling with the fact that you're no longer, you know, a young person. And I was then inducted into the slightly strange cult that is the House of Lords. And on my very first day there, I remember being introduced to a Lord who literally was 96 years old, literally. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not old. I'm so young. I'm so young. So the House of Lords has done a lot for my attitude towards life.
I mean, it's almost like you can't imagine a bigger contrast between the House of Lords on the one hand and YouTube.
It's impossible to imagine a bigger contrast. I mean, literally, you know, the House of Lords hasn't changed in many ways for 800 years, and YouTube and Silicon Valley, things change at the speed of light.
Mm. Could you say a little bit about what your title exactly? I've seen it written different ways, but what it is and what that means in terms of what you do at YouTube?
Yeah, my title is impenetrable. People tell me that job titles at YouTube and Google, don't really serve a function other than to fill the space. And so that's just as well, because my job title is Director of Diverse Marketing. Essentially, what I'm responsible for is driving diversity across YouTube, but specifically in terms of what you see when you go online. As an example, if you look at YouTube creators, although we're far more diverse than traditional media, and that's one of the most exciting things about YouTube, is it gives everyone a platform. However, there are really significant structural inequalities that you see in life as well. I mean, because YouTube is a reflection. So for example, only 23% of YouTubers are women. Mm. And as with most diversity issues, the interesting thing is, obviously it's not right and it's not good because it's a distortion of our world and it's excluding, you know, a percentage of the population that shouldn't be excluded and in fact who happen to be the majority, 51% and all that. But more than that, it turns out that women pull in more revenue essentially for YouTube than men. Female creators pull in more than male creators. So, you know, as is often the case with diversity, which is why it endlessly fascinates me, you can think about what's the right thing to do, and then you can think about what's the business thing to do. And often, you know, doing the right thing happily does actually also contribute to the bottom line.
So what does that mean? I guess what can YouTube do to increase diversity of among the creators and maybe also the users? I mean,
absolutely. It's so fascinating. We did some research into this, for instance, on the women stuff. We were like, we need more women creators. We want to be a balanced platform. We want to reflect our user base. So, you know, we want to be 50-50 by 2020. I'm in marketing. We have to talk in rhymes. I've actually never said that sentence before until it came out. I think I will repeat it often. 50-50 by 2020. Anyway, but the thing is, the research we did, for instance, we did some qualitative and quantitative, but in some of the interviews, women creators on YouTube, women YouTubers were saying to us, you know, I have a guy, a friend of mine, he makes YouTube videos as well. He rolls out of bed in the morning and just makes any old video. As a woman, I have to spend an hour and a half doing hair and makeup before I feel I'm presentable because I know I will get more abuse and I know that I'm judged that way. And then you look into it and it turns out that, and this is obviously the case across the internet, it's not to do with YouTube, but women are receiving online abuse at the rates of 300% above men. You know, and so what I always find fascinating about this area that I work in is that you're really trying to unpick the human condition and, you know, why do some groups face structural barriers? You can say it's self-imposed. Why does a woman feel she has to put makeup on before she can point a camera at herself? But on the other hand, she's going to feel real serious immediate consequences in terms of a barrage of hate speech and abuse and trolling online. And so, you know, it stands to reason that at the moment there are fewer women who are creators, and we will change that though. That's what the great thing about YouTube and about Google, and I suppose more generally about Silicon Valley, and what really interests me, attracts me to what you're doing in terms of Judaism and using some of the ideas around Silicon Valley as a blueprint, is that, you know, it's that old, we have the technology. You know, it's we have the technology, and we must use that technology to make things better. And often when you say a platitude like make things better, as I said, it does actually improve the business as well. There's a business case behind it too. Mm-hmm. Turns out inclusion is good for business.
But what practically, so you're describing this challenge that women creators, right, it's harder for them because in their psychology, at least, they have a belief that they have to put on makeup and do a lot more in order to do what YouTubers do, create a video.
Well, they're trained to believe that. I mean, right. They see stereotypes. Women, girls see stereotypes from birth. There's amazing, and I will answer your question in a second. There's amazing research, for instance, that shows girls decide they're not interested in tech or STEM, you know, science and engineering. But because of the stereotypes that they're bombarded with, they make that decision by the age of 6. So, you know, for me, someone who's in the past been a policymaker for 20 years, what I'm interested in is, well, how are we going to change those stereotypes that are bombarding them? And I'm like, well, what are they watching between the age of like 0 or 1 and 6? I hope no one's watching YouTube, even as a YouTube exec. I really hope people aren't watching YouTube before the age of 1 or 2, but we know they are. Anyway, you know, what can we do to change those stereotypes? And YouTube is the answer. That's why I'm so, you know, so excited about the possibilities of being here. So you were saying, what can be done? Well, what Google brings to most problems is scale and data. And so in my experience, I mean, I worked in British broadcasting. When I was in the House of Lords, I was head of diversity for a British broadcaster called Channel 4. And people, you know, probably haven't heard of Channel 4, but they may have heard of our film 12 Years a Slave. You know, we had a lot of acclaimed, and still do have a lot of acclaimed content. And what always changes behavior is transparency around the data. Now, Google can bring both that transparency and the data to the fore. Imagine what would happen if you could measure if you could measure which advertiser or which brand uses the most sexism to promote its adverts, you know, to promote its products. I mean, that would be a huge hit. You know, people wouldn't want to do that. And as soon as people realize there's a cost associated with thoughtless bias, because a lot of the time it is just thoughtless. And when I say thoughtless, I mean, it is deeply ingrained in our thought, but we don't do it on purpose. And so I'm interested in those people predominantly. I'm not really interested in trying to change the sort of dyed in the wool, keep the women at home, they shouldn't have left the kitchen type brigade. I'm not really wasting my time with them. It's the rest of us. We don't do it on purpose. You know, I mean, I used to say on British TV, it's not like British TV execs get up in the morning and say, keep women off our screens. But that's what happens in Britain. It's what happens in Hollywood. You know, you wonder, well, what is this? Is this Britain, America, or is it Saudi Arabian broadcast? Where are the women? And I did some research on it, which showed that, for instance, with British TV, other than the early groups where in the 20s you have young, pretty, attractive women who are put on TV because they're pretty, other than that group where they outnumber the boys because people want to look at the pretty women more than the boys, other than that one single demographic, the only other one where women outnumber men on TV is the over 100s because the men are dead. Mm. And so you really have to step back and say, wow, there's something really structurally wrong here. And so your question, what can we do? I mean, there are various things. The approach that I take is less legislation, even though obviously I come from a legislative background and I do enjoy changing the law when the opportunity presents itself, but it's not the first lever I look to. I want business to recognize there's a business interest and to do it themselves. And so, you know, more and more, there's a lot of, I mean, one of the things we do, for instance, is educate advertisers and brands and program makers and content creators themselves. So with advertisers, for instance, turns out, who knew, if you do the research, actually sex doesn't sell. If you do the research, it's really interesting that more often than not, objectifying a woman, draping a woman's body over a car actually doesn't sell as much as having an advert that empowers a woman. So we did this research in that YouTube CEO published, and that was what the data showed. So, you know, you can use the data to make people realize, oh, not only were we a bit stupid being mindlessly sexist, but we weren't actually maximizing our possible revenue potential. And so that's really what I want to do. It's that intersection of, you know, showing business what works for them. And like I said, to having this kind of Spike Lee approach at the same time. There's a ton of other things I could mention around tactics for women, but I don't think that's what this...
But then I'm thinking about the difference in what you're describing between YouTube and, let's say, a traditional broadcaster or other types of media, because, you know, right, YouTube is sort of the ultimate exemplar of this idea that we started with, where it's really empowering people to create.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, it's about how do we change the profile of the sort of advertising and other messages that are on YouTube and elsewhere, which hopefully over a long period of time will change societal norms and expectations, and over a long period of time will hopefully lead to changes.
Well, actually, my desire is to shrink that time change. Instead of it taking 40 years, I want it to take 4 years.
So how does it take 4 years?
Well, we did that in Britain with the Paralympics. I mean, we changed the British population's perception of disabled people. The amount of change in that perception that happened under normal circumstances would have taken like 4 decades. But essentially what we did was we smashed stereotypes. And I knew it had an impact. I mean, this sounds pretty bad, but it's, again, it's that same 11-year-old. I guess this is, what, 2012. So he was younger then. Maybe he's like 8 years old, 7 years old then. And he ran across the road and a car nearly ran him down. And I screamed at him, you know, you can't, just don't be so stupid. You nearly died. Are you crazy? The best that could happen is you'll end up in a wheelchair. And he immediately, he said, oh, but mommy, I don't mind if I lose both my legs. I can be a Paralympian. And I was like, my God, you know, when I was growing up, there was no upside associated to having a severe disability. You know, it's that shift. And I'm not saying there is now, but you get my point. Yep. That he did not see a man with no legs as someone who was terribly disadvantaged or disabled. He, in fact, said to me, and I had some difficulty answering the question, Mummy, why can that man without legs run faster than us? So it's a paradigm shift in the way people are viewing and thinking about disability. And so I want to use data and transparency at scale to shift, to create similar paradigm shifts around groups that are often stereotyped. And obviously the Jewish community is one group that has throughout its history felt the sharp end of what stereotypes and extreme prejudice can do.
You know, it's making me think about our mission as a organization, as a podcast, right? I mean, in many ways, if you put the word, let's say, uninvolved Jew instead of woman in everything that you've been saying, it tracks very close to our mission, right? Which is saying that right, a lot of people grow up thinking that Judaism is not for them, in the same way that a lot of girls grow up thinking STEM is not for them. Why? Because the view of Judaism that they've grown up seeing is one that's not for them, that doesn't include people like them, that isn't oriented towards activities that are important to them. And so they walk away with the assumption, yeah, this is just not for me. And what we're trying to grope at how to do is to say, yeah, you're right. The ways in which it's being done over there where you're looking is not for you. But there's still a lot of amazing material there. There's still a lot of stuff that can be reshaped in ways that are going to be successful for you. Now, what we've found in our interviews over the last year has been that the most exciting innovations in Jewish life have come when there was a person who had a problem, and they, for whatever accidental reason, realized that there was a Jewish material that could solve that problem in their own life, and then they created something that attracted their peers, right? The question is how to make their, and I analogize that to basically YouTubers. I mean, they're making a video, you know, they're creating something. But the challenge is how do you move from a majority of people who are kind of passively saying, yeah, that's not for me, and saying, I couldn't become a creator because I don't know enough, or whatever reasons people have, to saying, you know, yeah, you do have permission, you know, you do have enough. And then it's a question of what can we as an organization and other organizations like ours, what, and that's why I'm asking, what can YouTube do? Because it's like, if you're the organization that's trying to basically promote that more people should be doing this kind of activity, and more people of a certain kind that might not otherwise be doing it should be doing this activity, you know, what are the levers, what are the messages that you can use?
I mean, first of all, I think your approach is bloody brilliant. It's a bit of a British expression on it. But, you know, I grew up feeling not so much that Judaism wasn't for me, but that I could never be accepted as Jewish the same way, obviously, well, I suppose a bit more obvious, I could not be accepted as white. But it's funny, isn't it, those constructs, because I can always be accepted as black. So how is it you can have one white parent, one black parent, and you can go one way or not the other? A lot, obviously, that is codified for Judaism with one parent and not the other. But the point is that it was only when I really came under sustained attack for being Jewish within British politics, because I would always say I was Jewish, but most often it was phrased as, my mother is Jewish, therefore I'm Jewish. Because I felt slightly fraudulent otherwise. Because along with saying I am Jewish comes an expected package of other knowledge, insight, experience that I don't have. What I have is a mother who was brought up in an Orthodox Jewish home. And who felt Judaism definitely wasn't for her, for quite mundane reasons, really. I mean, I don't mean mundane, but I mean, for instance, she really wanted to study French. It was her passion, and she was only allowed to study Hebrew. So she just felt that she was put within constraints that she wanted to get outside of. And then she felt she didn't want to put her kids back into a particular grid. So to me, I'm sad that I don't have more inherent Jewishness within me. On the other hand, it chimed with me what you said, I saw on your website, you know, that so many Jews who aren't really quote unquote proper Jews are so proud of being Jewish. And so it was when I, as I said, came under sustained attack during a general election campaign, which was sort of widely reported as the dirtiest, nastiest election campaign in modern British history, that I really realized how important Judaism was to me. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? You know, if someone goes, you fucking Jew, you don't turn around and go, I'm not a Jew. You turn around and go, yes, I am a Jew. And what do you want to do about it? And what's your problem with that? And, you know, and so it, I suppose anti-Semitism, what I'm saying is that anti-Semitism really entrenched in me a very deep attachment to Jewish community and Jewish culture. And so what attracts me to everything that I've seen and read about what you're doing is that there would be a home there for someone like me. And now, as a mixed race person, I'm used to not really having a home. I'm on the fence all the time. I can see into each garden, but I'm not really totally invited into either. Do you know what I mean?
I do. But I mean, like, so in the way that you framed it at the very beginning of the answer that to my question was something along the lines of, you know, would I be included? And in a way, though, what I would be trying to sort of push at someone like you is to say, what would it look like for you to actually create a new Jewish community, even starting with your family or with a group of friends, right, in which there's no question that you're included. You're the creator of it. Right. So it's being defined around you and your values and your sense of what it means to be Jewish. Right? I mean, I definitely also think it's interesting how you relatively straightforwardly talk about how, well, Judaism defines whether you're a Jew in a very straightforward way, you know, based on is your mother Jewish, right? But in America, I think that that's become much less clear, you know, because, for example, the Reform Movement is so much bigger, and they define Judaism as also being if your father was Jewish. And there's so many other people who, you know, aren't really even in the weeds of that, and they just think of themselves as being Jewish because they do. You know, they probably have some ancestry, but they're not focused on exactly which parent it is. And in a sense, right, I think that's some of the amazing development of Judaism in America, that it's become kind of more blurry, but it's still not that blurry. And the question is, you know, I mean, we've actually talked about this a lot with a friend who's been on the podcast a lot, Rabbi B'nai Lappi, who's a lesbian Jew and wanted to become a rabbi. They had to go into the closet in order to go to rabbinical school because at that time they weren't accepting lesbian and gay rabbinical students. And but when she came out, when she came out of rabbinical school, not when she came out as a lesbian, I guess both happened at the same time. What she went and did was created a new organization for gay and lesbian Jews that was a Talmud study organization that said, you know, not only can we create a Jewish community for gay and lesbian Jews, but we can do the most Jewy of the Jewish things that anybody can imagine studying Talmud, right? You know, so in other words, we can seize this and make it our own, and then tell the straight and married Jews, you can come be guests in our place, right? And I love that, right? To me, it's like so in a sense, again, I sort of come back to that. You know, if I were to give that a snazzy name, I might say that's the YouTubeification of Judaism, right? It's saying Judaism is no longer this property of an institution in the way that you know, video, right, used to be the property of broadcasting networks.
It's the democratization of Judaism.
Right. And so somehow I think that, I mean, part of why I'm so interested in being here in Silicon Valley and trying to explore this is that, you know, we've accepted that with technologies, you know, but we don't seem to have yet fully accepted it in terms of whatever we want to call them, religions, wisdom, technologies, you know, et cetera. We still imagine that's the province of experts.
I think that's absolutely right, which is why the drop-off rates for participation in formal religion are so high. I mean, I think, you know, it's different strokes for different folks, isn't it? The point about the 21st century is that we are just all too busy and set upon to be consistent. And formal religion takes quite a lot of consistency traditionally. and we don't have just either the patience or the bandwidth for that. And so, you know, what's interesting to me is, well, what do I take from my the Jewish heritage that I have? I mean, my grandfather, a tailor, whose both his parents were Hungarian. He was the first child born outside Hungary. You know, his parents fleeing pogroms. And he, this belief of the importance of education, even being basically uneducated. I mean, uneducated, him and my grandmother. My grandmother left school at 13, but, you know, completely uneducated. And yet their belief in education was such that, you know, is this thing that, so my mother and her sister, when my aunt decided to marry a non-Jew, my grandfather turned her pictures to the wall. When 3 years later, my mum says not only is she marrying a non-Jew, but she's marrying a black man. Obviously, my grandparents were beyond devastated. However, because that black man had a PhD and had published a book, they were able to come to terms with it. Mm. They were more able to come to terms with a black educated man than a sort of run-of-the-mill white man. Because this, actually, that what I've said sounds very racist to me. But, you know, it's this just sort of almost devout attraction to education that the Jewish community and heritage has, that in the 21st century is what's going to get people through. It's the only thing that's going to get people through in a sort of ever-changing world of work and technology and so forth. You know, Judaism has this other thing which is important to me is, for me, I am an outsider insofar as, you know, in the school playground, I was, well, in my class at school, I was one of three kids out of 35 that weren't white. And I knew for a fact You know, there was a race matrix in my head that told me for a fact I did not have the same worth or value as the other kids. Not in terms of what I could do. I set my heart on being prime minister. That wasn't the point. It was in terms of being attractive or desirable to the mainstream group. I knew that instead I was somehow soiled, or that was the perception. I mean, the word in the playground was mongrel. Do you know what I mean? But so that gave me the perspective of an outsider. And no matter how much of an insider I ever am, whether it's because I, you know, work in the Prime Minister's office, or I'm a member of Parliament, or I'm in the House of Lords, I kind of carry it inside my DNA, being an outsider. And I think the Jewish community does that as well. And I think it's useful in the 21st century. In the past, it was just like quite sad, but it's useful in the 21st century because it's that, you know, diversity of experience, broader perspective, that gives you the edge quite often. That sounds quite trite, but, you know, if you look at Harvard Business School, the research they've published, it shows clearly that diversity of experience, teams with diversity of experience will always do better than teams with just higher IQ. Mm. And so collectively, I feel there's a wisdom around the Jewish community, which could be harnessed. And just bringing in more people, to my mind, makes it stronger, whereas obviously historically it was always the exact opposite.
Well, I mean, that's the trick in a way. The question is, can you, you know, once that group of outsiders is sort of brought inside, is more tolerated, more welcomed, you know, more intermarried and interspersed in, are you able to retain that, that those benefits of being an outsider through some system? And, you know, I do think that some of the traditional Jewish practices, particularly the whole idea of the Jewish holidays being reenactments of these historical experiences, were perhaps designed in order to try to allow us to remember those times when we were in a bad situation, even if we come to a good situation, right? The challenge seems to me to be that a lot of people aren't engaging in those practices because they come packaged with a whole set of other stuff which seems unattractive and not valuable anymore. And, you know, so in a way, the question goes back to, you know, some Jewish organizations are out there saying, we believe Judaism is this way, and our mission is to try to get other people to buy into it. You know, but our mission, and I think a lot of the missions of the organizations that we're talking to on this podcast, is really much more about saying, we want to empower you. We want, like you said, we want to democratize. We want to give people the chance to say, come and look at this stuff and pick out the stuff that you think is good. Mix it up in new ways yourself. Try it out. See if it works for you. See if it works for others. And let's sort of rebuild it over time. And in a way, the question, and I think maybe this connects both to your political experience and your experience or thinking about YouTube, is, right, how do you try to get the mass of regular people to kind of use the toolbox that's at their disposal, either the tools of living in a free and democratic society, or the tools of being able to make awesome videos and share them and post them? How do you get them to use them well, you know, to use them constructively? What are the incentives that can be put out there? What are the levers that can be pulled?
Yeah, I think there are two things. One is utility and one is belonging. I mean, obviously, the one theme you've spoken about is how useful you can make something, and that is a very attractive proposition. And really what we're talking about, you know, how you were saying you could get people in and say, look, these things are useful to you. It's kind of like looking upon Judaism as a Spotify playlist for religion. Come and choose the music that you like, the sound that you like, the mood music that you like. I think it's important to recognize, you know, because some people be horrified at that, absolutely horrified at that. I can understand it, but my horror is more that you just slowly have a withering of a community because it is so fixed in its ways. In, you know, you were saying, how can you get the best, I think you were, was the question maybe, out of people, out of religion, out of, and I think I mean, if we look in terms of the internet, you know, on YouTube, YouTube is a community, and we get very concerned if there are bad things happening in that community. We don't want hate speech on YouTube. So we have to look at, you know, what are the mechanisms to reduce that? And sorry, I didn't answer fully. I promised I would. There was a politician. I said, I'll come back to that question. And I don't think I did, because you were asking specifically, what can you do? But for example, specifically, you can build a product that makes it easier to make the comments system more or safer from trolls. You know, I mean, there are some specific product applications that you can add that give YouTubers more control over what's on their comment feed and can shut down, really abusive stuff. Obviously, there's always a tension, because maybe that means people would abuse that and take anything off that isn't good, and you get a sort of North Korea approach to, you know, looking at your comment feed. But on the whole, that isn't at all what happens, because the thing about YouTube, and it is very much a modern phenomenon, is what attracts people, and especially millennials, to YouTubers as opposed to TV, is that there is an honesty and an authenticity about it. Even if you watch, and it horrifies me that any of my kids might watch hours and hours of beauty tutorials. In fact, I probably, you know, literally ban them from wearing lipstick for life. I'll go all Taliban on them if they do this. But the point is that you could, instead of watching those hours and hours of that, you can be exposed to anything and everything. And that brings dangers. We all know what the dangers are, but it brings extraordinary opportunities. Some of the other tools available are specifically around building community. We do that for creators who are underrepresented. We invest in them. We have development programs for them. And it's this thing of trying to say, look, if YouTube is the world's living room, in a technological sense, YouTube is the world's living room. Well, we want that living room to be a nice environment. And we want that living room to be open to all, not closed for structural reasons to some. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about how you can do that in practical terms, in terms of the product. The other thing is, you know, it's a quite boring mantra that I have, that if you do the right thing, it quite often pays off. Well, conversely, when you are not inclusive, you quite often pay the price. And there's a great example within Google engineering, when there was a product came out. It was something for photos, Google Photos, or it was something to do with photos. I can't remember exactly. But the point is that it kept not working for 10% of all the photos with this software. They kept coming in upside down. And 10% is a significant number. That was a real problem. There'd been a huge amount of money spent on the launch and all the rest of it. And they racked their brains. They couldn't work it out. And then someone was like, well, aren't sort of like 10% of the world's population left-handed? And it was literally because they had not had any left-handed person in it, and all the pictures came in upside down for left-handed people, because no one on the product team had tested that. And it cost billions of dollars. So, you know, it's just about having wider perspectives, wider teams with a greater range of diversity. And religion often tends in the opposite direction of that. So what's exciting to me about what you're saying is that you're moving towards the future whilst bringing with you really important elements of the past.
Mm-hmm. Can you just sort of in sort of thinking towards the end, well, two things. One, I mean, I'm just curious if there are thoughts that you have rolling in you that you want to share, you know, that we haven't asked you about. But also I wanted to just sort of ask you if a little bit for YouTube and for you, you know, YouTube in general and your role here, you know, what does the world look like sometime in the future? You know, what is the transformation that, would really make Google and YouTube feel like we've really accomplished what we're here to accomplish?
What we, I think, want to do, I mean, you know, Google's aim is a very lofty, majestic one. It is summed up nicely in a one-liner, which is something along the lines of organizing all the world's information and making it universally accessible. And so what attracts me to Google is that, I look at it from the perspective of an Apple addict. I mean, I am the quintessential Apple addict. It's my Apple Watch, it's my iPad Pro, it's my iPhone 7. These are all things that I literally love almost more dearly than my children. It's disgraceful. But when I realized that Apple essentially makes luxury products for people who can already afford them, whereas Google's actual mission is to get technology to the people who can't, then that really excites me. And I know which side I come down on. You know, am I going to bring out my inner Gucci or my inner Gandhi, basically, which is why I put my iPhone 7 down. But the point is that in terms of what Google wants to achieve, it's really quite high-minded missions like that. Now, I know there'll be a ton of people out there going, no, they don't. They just want your data. It's all about privacy and, you know, et cetera. But being inside the building, it feels very different. Things often do, don't they? They're different when you're inside to when you're outside. And as I said, I must carry that perspective of an outsider. But I think ironically, Google does quite a bad job at marketing its core mission. Because if you ask Europeans, and I'm saying this from a European perspective, what does Google do? They'll say, well, Google, you know, just wants to steal your data and make money from advertising, and that's it. That, you know, there isn't any upside. Whereas what I see, you know, the upside that I see is actually literally giving people in some of the poorest countries a chance to make a living. I mean, it's doing extraordinary things. A product just launched in India, giving people access to the internet, giving poor farmers in Africa access to technology, knowledge that they hadn't had, that saved crops, that saved lives, giving girls access to education. You know, there are so many things that... The big thing, though, I think the big thing I want to see is I would like to see Google's extraordinary knowledge and intelligence in the area of technology, specifically the area of artificial intelligence. I would like to see that directed at cracking the issue of stereotypes. Because we have so many stereotypes for so many groups. And so the reason I'm here anyway is in the long term, and I admit I'm not going to do it by 4 p.m. next Tuesday, but in the long term, that is fundamentally what I want to see on the one hand about the bigger question of, you know, stereotypes and how people's life chances are limited. And then on the other, in terms of YouTube, I want to see which direction the internet is going to go. Are we going to let people sit down and relax in the living room, or is it actually going to be a war zone, you know, where only some people can survive and make a living? So on both counts, whether it's Google or YouTube, it's a really fascinating moment to be here. And I think it's amazing that you've taken some of the elements of Silicon Valley, like around disruption in particular, and applied it to religion. That's just, yeah, well done.
Hope our listeners will be able to listen to these conversations and have them have these conversations help them help us think about what the next steps for the Jewish community can be that kind of tracks some of these new ways of thinking and some of these new technologies, whether it's about using the technologies themselves or just being inspired by the idea of the technologies to say, you know, what would it look like if we really democratized Jewish creativity, you know, and if we can't quite picture what that would look like, at least we might be able to picture what the result might look like. And if we could put out an inspiring end result like you just did, I think that would be part of the inspiration to start doing the work. So,
well, it's funny you say next steps, though, because literally I was just listening to a podcast this morning and they said, it was a professor from Cambridge, and he said, so I have my definition of intelligence. And I was like, oh, wow, a definition of intelligence. This is going to be interesting. I must remember this one. And he said, our definition of intelligence, he's a professor on artificial intelligence, is knowing what the next step should be. Intelligence is knowing just what the next step is. So no pressure, but just make sure you get the next steps right.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on this episode. It was a real thrill.
A great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And it's Lex back again. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I certainly did as pure listener and not co-host this time. It was fun to step into your shoes. And we want to close out the episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can always head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. And the last plug we like to make is that you can always support us financially with a one-time donation or a recurring monthly donation. And you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been week 3 of the Omer and Judaism Unbound.